Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I have a good program for you tonight, and after spending the past 2 weeks looking at what are, to my mind, purveyors of disinformation, I'm going to sort of continue correcting some things that I said last week so that I don't put out misinformation myself. So I have a few minor corrections in some of the things I said last week. Webster Tarpley's book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, does not have George Bush's face on the cover, as I said. That was just a kind of a misspeaking on my part. He's got Tony Blair's face, along with Cheney's, Rumsfeld's, Wolfowitz's, Muhammad Atta, and Osama bin Laden. You see how I like to be so correct that I don't want to leave a mistake like that out there, even though nobody mentioned it to me, but I thought of it myself. I'd like to add a couple more things that I left out because of a lack of time. One thing is that in his 9/11 book, Tarpley thanks three people in particular for their help. The first is Ralph Schoenemann, who's had that Taking AIM radio program for a long time. I don't know if it's still on the air. I used to listen to it, and I think Ralph Schoenemann is a good guy. But, you know, he is a socialist. He has the world socialism outlook in kind of in the Marxist labor tradition. And the second is the Russian Jew named Bundarevsky of the Russian Academy of Sciences, which was at one time the Soviet Academy of Sciences, and he was there at that time, too. Tarpley's wrote in his book that in 1991, when he was still employed by the LaRouche Executive Intelligence Review, that's the main name that they have for themselves. It was this Russian Jew who gave him the nudge to write the book about Prescott Bush. So he's pretty friendly with this man. And the third is another Russian, a professor, Muranivsky of Moscow State University. And this Muranivsky was president of the Schiller Institute in Moscow at the time that Tarpley was the head of the Schiller Institute in the United States. And, of course, that's the LaRouche organization. It's obvious that Tarpley is very pro-Russian, and I am not, you know, I'm not saying anything against the current Russia, but Tarpley definitely has a strong connection with the Russian point of view. And he's very anti-Anglo-American, whom he sees only as in the guise of finance capitalists. He sees the rest of the world as victims of Anglo-American conspiracy. Well, definitely, Anglo-Americans have a lot that they're doing in as far as finance capital and being under the control of the Jews, a great deal. And yet, that's not all there is to Britain and the Anglos and to America and Americans. And we need to see, you know, I think he would like to see Anglo-American world be brought down totally and the rest of the world rise up in its place. I don't know how good that would be. So that's why I look with suspicion on him. And there are a lot of Jews in the LaRouche movement, and naturally Tarpley is very Jew-friendly. And he never, the LaRouche movement never draws attention to the Jews or to the Jews that it has within it. So moving on to some additional information on Henry Mackow. Now, I said last week that I couldn't find much personal information on him, but then right after I did the program, I looked him up again, and then I saw something that I hadn't noticed before, and it comes from Wikipedia Dramatica. If you've never gone to a page at Wikipedia Dramatica, I would just tell you to beware, because it's pretty strange. I had never seen one before, but it came up under his name, and it brought up an article. In the article there, Wikipedia Dramatica had a whole page on Henry Mackow, and it linked to an article by David Icke, in which was titled "Children of Nazi Survivors," which revealed that Henry Mackow is a Polish Jew who was born in Switzerland to immigrant parents who had escaped from Nazi-occupied Poland. But it said that his grandparents perished and that his parents only survived by posing as Catholics. This I found really interesting because, of course, Henry has converted to Christianity. And I say, well, is he really a Christian? His parents were posing as Catholics. Maybe he's posing as a Christian. And here's the thing that really comes to my mind, because many of you who listen to me regularly, you know how I think, that he's not just Polish. He's a Polish Jew. And Polish Jews are notorious haters of not just Hitler and his regime, but of Germany itself, and are committed to keeping Germany in a subservient position vis-a-vis their neighbors via the World War II mythology. So the fact that Henry is promoting all of this World War II mythology in the way that he does is just, you know, he's just behaving true to form. This is what I would expect. Now, more about Henry is that he's a child star of sorts. After he came to Ottawa with his parents, well, he was born there. His parents came there. And then at the age of 12, he started writing an advice column in a local newspaper. And the article says that, in Dramatica, says that he got to do that through his parents' connections. I don't know if they know anything about that or not, but since most papers are owned by Jews and they were Jewish immigrants, they may have had some connections just for that reason. But and Henry was obviously a bright boy, and he got some idea to write this column, and the newspaper carried it, and then it eventually ran in 35 newspapers during the 60s, and it was called Ask Henry. And then a book came out that was of all of his columns, and the book was a bestseller. And he was only 12 years old when his book came out, because he was on the game show or the panel show, What's My Line? And he was a contestant there. They had to guess what his occupation was. And it's on YouTube, and you can, if you Google it, you'll be able to see it. He's a cute little kid and very well behaved. And they couldn't quite guess it. And, the moderator said that he was 12 years old and he had already had his book published. So here is Henry Mackow, very bright. And then, he also invented that board game that was also very successful. So maybe his connections helped him with that too, because a lot of people invent things and don't get anywhere with them. But Henry certainly did, and but yet then he became very disillusioned, supposedly, by everything after all that success, and seemed to have some personal difficulties in his life and within his relationships. So I don't really know the story about Henry Mackow, but I know that the fact that he is the son of Polish Jews who survived Nazi-occupied Poland, somehow that's what they say, they survived it, they left, they went to Switzerland, and that they posed as Catholics, and well, it's just all very strange. Also, the fact that Henry and David seem to be good friends. Now, moving along here, a correction on Wayne Mattson. You know, another one. I said he worked in Navy intelligence during the Vietnam War. He wasn't in the Vietnam War. He came along after. I kind of knew that as I was saying it, but I didn't want to stop and go back, you know, or corrected, I just kept going. But he was active in the Navy in the 80s. I also want to point out, what I didn't have time to do, I mentioned it, but that some people have mentioned to me, well, but he writes very good intelligence reports, and he comes up with good information. Yeah, you know, I have noticed that his reports are heavy on the sex angle. And you remember that he was supposedly had problems in his career with, well, because there were these pedophilia rings in the Navy that and he wasn't supposedly, I guess he was maybe calling them out or something, and so he got in trouble, and I mean he wasn't very well liked. I don't know about that, but here I know that he continues with the sex angle in his life, and all these he has so many intelligence reports where they're about lewd behavior of one kind or another, including up to pedophilia. Those are his favorite subjects. He likes to smear people he doesn't like, I think, and he likes to get down in the gutter. I really think he's kind of a gutter snipe, and I will say that most of his predictions, he makes predictions, but they don't materialize for the most part, and that doesn't bother him. He just goes ahead and makes some more. Well, that's all right. At least he has the nerve to make a prediction. But I don't think that what he has offered so far has been all that great, except when it comes to the sex lives of these politicians, which is a good thing. It's a good thing to know about that. The other thing is that he might just be angry at the world because he's, let's face it, he's a very homely guy, and he's short, and he's unmarried, and I don't think he's very successful with the ladies, and so he might just feel like he's been excluded from so much, and he has a lot of anger in him, and he identifies a lot with blacks. He says, he's like, he feels their pain. He's concerned with blacks, and he really doesn't like white people very much. Well, I probably really stepped on it here, but I'm going to go on now and talk about an idea that I want to get across today, and that is, after looking at all these people coming out with all this stuff and getting followers and having people spend so much time listening to them and following them and commenting about them and getting a lot of strange ideas, false ideas from what they come in contact with from these people. I'm talking about the 9 people on my list. It occurs to me, and it's not the first time though, that ignorance is the enemy. And I really do think that, what we really have to battle is ignorance. Now everybody thinks that they're battling ignorance, but there is a way to understand whether people are really are really trying to educate others, or are they trying to keep people from being educated. Now we have to understand that that there's going to be infiltrators. I know you do understand that. Maybe I'm the one that needed to understand that to really come really come face to face with the seriousness of this problem, because infiltrators bring a high powered energy. They bring success. They bring usually they look very capable. They make a good impression, and they're hard to resist. They're not going to look like losers, So, and they're everywhere. And it makes sense that they would be everywhere, because those who don't want it, because ignorance is what it's what keeps us from taking any kind of action or overthrowing the people who are in control above us. And today, those people are Jews, or the Jewish lobbies, the Jewish cabals, the Jews that are totally overrepresented in all areas of the United States economy and cultural life. So to keep us from doing anything about this, they have to do something, and so they're putting these people everywhere to play games with our minds and to keep us busy and to keep us from actually naming, that's a kind of a corny thing to say, naming the Jew, but from actually, talking about the Jew with all this business about, political correctness and so on. And every one of these people on my list is unwilling to go after the real enemy. So I have come up with some ideas. And my guest that I'm going to bring on in the second half of the program also has ideas, no doubt better than mine. But I want to make a couple of points. And that is that we all have this this need to belong, to identify with others, to feel like we fit somewhere. This is never going to go away. This is basic to human beings and human natures. And so this is used to keep us away from our own inner wisdom. You know, I really think a lot about inner wisdom. I mean, I think highly of my own inner wisdom. I couldn't function very well without it because I would just fall into traps right and left, like I used to do when I was young. Although I did have inner direction then, which did save me in ways that I didn't even understand at the time. But to be inner directed, I think, is very important. And inner direction requires two things. One, to know where your self-interest lies. And two, to be able to meditate and commune with yourself. The reason I say this is that, for number one, to know where your self-interest lies. If you think your self-interest lies in a universal God who cares about all people equally and therefore so should you, you know, you are in the enemy's camp. You cannot be of any help to what we need to accomplish as, and I'm talking as a European, for the European people, for the survival and the continuance of the European people and their evolution. We are the most highly evolved people on the planet, in my opinion. That doesn't make us better, but it does make us necessary. And we should just, we're just necessary for ourselves. We don't want to see what we are disappear. So our self-interest has to be that we are for ourselves. That's what it means, you know. If you don't care about yourself, you don't have any self-interest. If you think that you are here to do for others, then you need to examine that, exactly what that means to you. Just what others are you talking about? Because if you don't look out for yourself, I will tell you, no one else is going to. Now, there's something called codependence, codependency. And that is when you think that if you take care of someone else, he or she will take care of you. If you do for someone else, they're going to do back for you. You're not thinking of doing for yourself. You want them to do for you. And then you expect them. I know. Yeah, you want them to do for you, and you're gonna do for them instead of yourself. See, this is not the way to go about it, because this always ends up in terrible results. That's a known fact. Everybody has to say what is good for me. You know why? Because only you know what is good for you. Nobody else knows how to take care of you. Only you do. And this takes us to the second part. To be able to meditate and commune with yourself. This is essential for being able to sense or feel what is right for you and what isn't. This is important because the way you feel about things will tell you everything about what they are and how good they are for you. And if they're not good for you. You know, if the feeling that you will have, that your inner being, which everyone has, will tell you, will give to you, is a feeling of joy. When you come across something new or something where not everything gives you any particular feeling one way or the other, but if something does, and if it's a feeling of joy, you can be assured, without knowing anything more about it, that it's good for you, that it's right for you, and that it won't hurt you. But if you have a feeling of being disturbed, or not feeling comfortable, feeling it depresses you, or it just makes you feel bad. It makes you feel maybe even scared, or like there's something not alien to you. Then follow that. Go along with it, even if you might be intellectually convinced, or your friends are going along with it, or whatever. Don't do it, and it's not going to come on you like a sledgehammer. It's going to be a fairly subtle feeling often, particularly until you get more used to it. But if we're not used to sensing what our inner self is telling us, we are in a jungle where we don't have good guideposts. You can find things that might guide you, but nothing is as good as this. And so everybody needs to spend some time meditating and communing with themselves. If you have done a lot of it, I did a lot of it in my past, and I don't really need to do that every day because that's all established in me. It still would be better if I did spend more time doing that right now, but it would only be for my own pleasure. All right, to move on, this is what I have to say on how to overcome ignorance, to get all of us, to do these two things. And once we do, we can stand up to people who are pushing ignorant ideas. And we need to stand up to them. That the only answer to this, the only answer to the problem that we have, is that we stand up to the people who are pushing junk on us or who are trying to take control of our life. No matter how difficult it is, no matter how politically incorrect it is, this has to be done. I came upon something just this morning that I had written on my Ellie Wiesel website in the article Shadowy Origins of Night 2. It's talking about the Polish Holocaust books that were survivor books that were written after the war, and in particular, speaking of the one that supposedly Ellie wrote, it says an unusual circumstance among East European Jews was that was their ignorance as late as the spring of 1944 of the scale and nature of the Germans' genocidal intentions. And this just popped out to me because I thought, there it is for my ignorance talk. You know, because it is our ignorance today. Then they're saying that they were ignorant of the scale and nature of the genocidal intentions against them. Well, today, we Gentiles are, for the most part, ignorant of the scale and nature of the Jewish genocidal intentions against us. And this is proven by the fact that probably some of you listening will say, oh, you're going too far. Oh, genocidal intentions, come on. And if you try to talk like this or explain this to most people, they will react like you're a ridiculous fool. But this is the ignorance. You see, we are ignorant of this. A few of us, some of us are not ignorant, but this is something we have to become more and more aware of. And you're not going to do it by preaching to people who don't want to listen. You're only going to do it by practicing your own bravery in the face of this and speaking out about it, and people follow examples. If people like what they see in you, they will follow your example. They're not going to listen to your blabbing about them when you're not doing anything yourself except talking on the internet. Even doing it on the internet is important, very important. So my guest that I'm going to that will be with us after the break is named J.B. Campbell. And while he is a well-known person and has been around for a long time, I was not living in the country when he, during the time of this militia movement. He is the founder of the militia movement that got stopped dead by the explosion of the Murrah building in Oklahoma. We all know what that was all about. So I don't know what he's been doing since then, but I have seen his name. I know his name had come before me, but I just did not connect with this person at all until the other day when I saw an article, not on Veterans Today site, but somewhere else by him. And I was so impressed, I Googled his name and found that everything about him was on Veterans Today. Strangely enough, as you know, for me. But I went and I thought, what is he doing on this on this site? You know, I looked at some of the things he had written. I thought, boy, oh boy. And now I understand that he is putting his writings there because the Veterans Today management allows him to do so and does not censor his work. And he gets a very wide readership there. So, you know, I accept that. I've talked with him a bit, we've exchanged a little bit, and I've read a lot of his material in the last couple of days, and I am very impressed. J.B. Campbell, J. Bruce Campbell, who does what I think we need to do. And I couldn't be more in accord with what he's saying. Can he be a disinfo agent? Well, you know, it certainly has crossed my mind, ladies and gentlemen. But for many reasons, he's been at this too long, and he speaks too clearly. He doesn't go around in circles. He speaks very clearly, to the point, and makes excellent sense and has a great grasp of history. And I'm going to encourage you to read everything you can by him. And we have to take our break now. When we come back, he will be with us. Thank you.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
They are signs of American power and might. Military bases spread all over the world. Just how many? Apparently, too many to count.
What I'm relatively sure of is that there are no less than 1,077 U.S. bases or sites in foreign countries. And likely there's actually many more than that. We just can't be sure.
But what we can be sure about is that the U.S. defense budget is now about the same as military spending in all other countries combined. And since 9/11, military and security expenditures have soared by 119%. Military expenditures in faraway places like New Zealand, Colombia, and Japan. And have you ever heard of the Marshall Islands, Kwajalein Atoll specifically? Well, the United States is there too. And some locations serve dual purposes, like Guantanamo Bay. And they're all sustained by hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer money. Just how much money?
I don't think anyone really knows the full cost. The Pentagon doesn't keep good tabs, actually, on all the miscellaneous expenses.
And speaking of those miscellaneous expenses,
there were a lot of golf courses tucked away in shadowy places that the Pentagon would rather people not look into.
Golf courses and ski lodges? That's a little bit extra, isn't it?
And Brian Becker of the Answer Coalition says it's not just the golf courses that are extra.
Clearly, there's no need, from the point of view of self-defense, for the U.S. to have military installations all over the world. It's really part of maintaining a far-flung global empire. Each place the U.S. has a military base, the U.S. has political power, economic power. And it's a matter of coercion.
A coercion that isn't always welcome. In fact, it usually breeds more anti-American sentiment. For example, in Kyrgyzstan,
we are living here and raising our children. Why do we need this U.S. air base?
Or in Okinawa, where locals have to give up 10 to 20% of the island to the United States for a military base that they associate with noise, crime, and pollution. And take a look at this. In the wake of demonstrations in Okinawa last year, activists placed this ad in the Washington Post, trying to tell the Obama administration that they don't want a base in their hometown.
All of the proxy governments that accept U.S. military bases in to their country become vulnerable once the people actually start to rise up and mobilize, which they almost always do.
Rising up against a double standard.
The U.S. would never tolerate China having military bases in Canada, in Mexico, in Haiti, in the Dominican Republic. In other words, in the countries that ring the United States. The United States is the 700-pound gorilla. It sits wherever it chooses to sit.
And choosing to sit down wherever usually means that those most...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and with me now is J. Bruce Campbell. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm very glad to have you here. The first thing I'd like to ask you is why there's so little about you on the Internet. Looking you up, I found you on Veterans Today and a couple things, but there was no Wikipedia entry. And for someone who was the founder of the U.S. militia movement, that was such a well-known thing back then. I'm kind of surprised at that.
Well, in those days, you know, I wrote the book and I started the movement, but I kind of cultivated obscurity because it was a very dangerous thing I was doing. I went ahead to Montana to help those people up there after I found out, you know, they had this thing called the Militia of Montana that I didn't know it was a FBI front until I was involved with them for a while. But I never sought any kind of a, you know, following, or it was a very risky thing I was trying to do, so I was being as careful as possible. And of course, I'm probably the only guy in the country that hasn't been attacked by the ADL. They just will not mention my name. So I don't get any negative publicity. I don't get any positive publicity. I don't seek it.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. So even at that time, your name was not that well known?
No, nobody. I mean...
Oh, okay. Your name just rings like J.B. Campbell. Like, maybe it sounds like somebody else's name, but it's kind of like, oh, why didn't I should have recognized that. That name really, you know, strikes me as somebody that I knew about who wrote a lot of things, but I may be mixing it up with somebody else.
Well, I wrote a lot for Rents ever since about 2004 or something like that. I started writing quite a bit, maybe earlier than that, 2002.
yeah, you know, I never got in the habit of reading Rents, although I have been there when something that I'm looking for happens to be on there. So you told me that a lot of that some of these sites that we wouldn't think would do that were censoring your articles some, and that's why you're happy at Veterans Today, because he's not doing that.
Yeah, I don't know what your listenership is used to, but I pretty much made it possible for Jews to be discussed on the internet with an article I wrote for Rents. And it wasn't easy. I mean, he was even a little skeptical. He just said, well, I don't think you should, you know, I don't think we can run it this way. You're going to have to change some words around. So I rewrote that thing I believe I sent you called Jewish Rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the article that really started the whole willingness to say, well, I guess, you know, maybe we do have a Jewish problem here.
Really? And this article ran on Rents in what year?
2006.
And the one that I looked at was at Gnostic Liberation Front, and it said it had been posted or had come from Judicial Biz, that website. That, how did you have anything to do with that?
No, people thought I did. People thought I did. I don't know why they assumed that. And nobody knows, as far as I know, who had Judicial Inc. It was a mystery who ran it. The Rents article came out, and then this fellow or person or gal, I don't know who, had it, added some pictures to the Rents article, and it became kind of a classic.
Well, it's great. It's just great. Yeah, I had not read it, although I may have seen it back when and, you know, didn't connect you, and in the meantime, you know, forgot about it or something. But as it appears now on GnosticLiberationFront.com, and I'm going to give it's www.GnosticLiberationFront.com/Jewish_rule.htm for people to go there. Is it in the censored form, or is it in the form that you wrote it?
No, that's the form I wrote it. Now, the Judicial Inc. guy put the headings, the headings on the paragraphs, or, you know, so I didn't do that, but... He really moved it up. He really jazzed it up with those pictures and everything.
Yes, that he did, and that's why it made me wonder if it was if things get too jazzed up, you start to worry about them a little bit. But really, reading it is just it's just fantastic. Some things that I pointed out, I want to ask you about, which I think will lead into what I finally want to talk to you about is you say the problem is this is just a sentence taken out of it. The problem is Christianity, which is Judaism for Gentiles. Christians cannot deal with Jews because they believe that Jews are God's chosen people. If this is true, this puts us in a real problem, doesn't it?
I think it is the problem, the basic problem we have, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then you say to become a Christian is to deny yourself the right of survival, and then a few other things, and then it assures the Jew that the enemy will not fight back.
Yeah, I you know, those whom the Jews destroy, they first make Christian, because that's the way to avoid.
You said that too. Well, we have, yeah, and we have so many good Christians, and I don't, you know, nobody wants to talk against Christianity. And there are some who pretty much can overcome these things and be fighters, but for the most part, it's still an incredible problem. I think so. That's the way I see it. But you say that, you make it very plain that we need to overthrow Jewish rule against this. In fact, here it is. The purpose of this essay is to prepare the reader for a life of struggle against Jewish rule in this country.
It's so simple to see what I'm talking about. Looking at Russia after 1917, what happened to all the Christians in Russia, I don't even know how many millions, but, you know, there's wild numbers, like 20, at least 20 million Christians were slaughtered by the Jewish Bolsheviks, and maybe more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We saw what happened to Germany, both after World War I and World War II. If you look at James Bach's books, Crimes and Mercies, about the genocide of the German people following World War II, done by Eisenhower, and specifically the POWs, about a million, over a million POWs were starved to death from May to December of 1945 on his explicit orders to starve them to death. And then we look at Gaza, we look at, you know, Palestine in general. This is Jewish rule. This is what it's like to live under Jewish rule, and it is a nightmare. So
yes, well, you're right. But here we have people who insist on calling it Zionist and insist on saying, bring up the argument that Jews are not monolithic, and therefore there's all kinds of Jews, and it's wrong to lump them together as the Jews. And that's really ingrained in people's minds. So what can we say to that?
Well, that's the truth. It is ingrained, but there's a simple test. You know, can ask it. And everybody says, "Well, I've got Jewish friends," and I have Jewish friends too. But my Jewish friends admit exactly what I'm saying. They say, you know, it's not that I'm saying it; it's just this is the truth. And you can pull an easy quiz on one. Well, what about the Kol Nidre? Do you condemn the Kol Nidre, which, you know, is a horrible oath or a prayer that's given every Yom Kippur, every Day of Atonement, which excuses the prayer giver for the year in advance for any crimes he commits. Essentially, you can lie, cheat, steal, whatever, and you're forgiven a year in advance for these crimes. So you can ask your Jewish friends, well, what do you think about this Kol Nidre? You think it's legitimate? And that's a pretty good test. And then there's other things to do, like, you know, anti-Semitism. I asked Alan Dershowitz one time on a show about called anti-Semitism. I said, "Do you have one drop of Semitic blood in your body?" Well, he said, "I must admit, I'm uncomfortable with that term." I said, "What term?" He said, "Anti-Semitism." I said, "What are you talking about? This show is called anti-Semitism." Well, I just think there should be a better word. In other words, there should be a word that you can use to shut people up and not be a lie. Because the whole concept of anti-Semitism suggests, mind you, just only suggests that you're criticizing someone who has a right to live in Palestine because, you know, you're anti-Semitic, so you're against well, ask any Jew if he is a Semite. And this is a very offensive concept to Jews. So, you know, there are all kinds of ways to deal with this.
Yeah, but none of them seem to work too well. I mean, except for people who are ready to listen to that. But the people who hold on to this thing that I don't want to hear any more about the Jews. That's just so paranoid. You know, there's no such thing as the Jews. They're the liberals. They're almost always liberals, and there are a lot of liberals. And they're pretty much what's in the way. So there's another thing, and that leads us into communism. You talk about communist Jews and Zionists, but mm-hmm. you don't talk about fascists. And almost everybody on Veterans Today talks about fascists. And all these people that I was talking, that I've spent my last two programs on, talking about disinformation specialists, talk about fascists a lot. Please say something about that.
Well, I use the word fascism in a strict sense. You know, the Italian 20 years or so under Mussolini, which he said, well, it's not fascism, it's really corporatism. And I'll use it for that. I got called a fascist by Clint Eastwood's reader. She called me a fascist for a screenplay that I had submitted about my experience over in Africa back in the 70s. Well, fascist in that regard just means anti-communist or anti-Jew. That's their dirty word for anybody who resists them. You're a fascist. But to me, it's not a legitimate term. It should be used only to describe what Mussolini was doing in Italy for those 20 years.
Yeah, whatever. But you know that now it's the word. I mean, everybody's throwing it around, and it really means nationalism. I mean, if you are nationalist, if you like nationalism, that means you're a fascist. That's what they use for that.
Oh, I'm
and
sure.
So you think that the distinction between nationalists and internationalists is more telling than any other distinction, just about to see where people stand?
Exactly. In fact, at the back of my book that I wrote years ago, it said, I get a picture of myself, and it says, the author's experience in Rhodesia persuades him that betrayal by leaders must be punished harshly and our nationalism be reestablished progressively.
Tell us the name of your book, A Call to Arms, isn't it?
That was a subtitle. It was called The New American Man, A Call to Arms. That was, you know, that's the thing that started the militia movement. There's about 2,700 copies of it. And it's kind of a collector's item now, but I'm going to be reissuing it online here as soon as I get a scanner. I just scan it in and make it available online.
That'll be great, because I asked you about it, and it's not really available.
But communism, that's the issue to me. That's Jewish rule. I mean, Zionism.
Well, people say communism doesn't exist anymore. You know, they wash that away. And the problem now is fascism. So, but yet, there you are still talking about communism. Do people give you, nobody seems to be giving you a hard time about that.
Oh, no, not at all, because it's so plain. I stick up for Joe McCarthy, and anybody that goes against McCarthy, I say, well, come on now, this guy, you can't believe what he was up against. All he was trying to do was warn us about what our government was doing, mainly to other people overseas. I mean, my position is that the United States government, the State Department, created every single communist government since 1917, when we sent Leon Trotsky and his 350 Bolsheviks from the Lower East Side of Manhattan over to St. Petersburg to meet up with Lenin. That was an American deal, and created.
And who is we? Who did that in the name?
Well, see, I'm my whole reason for being is pretty much to bring down the Council on Foreign Relations, to destroy this malignant private ministry of subversion and war, the one in New York in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And the WE is this private group called the CFR. Now, they were founded formally in 1921, but these same guys, the Dulles brothers and Robert Lansing and Colonel House and all these megalomaniacs, were in the Woodrow Wilson administration from 1912, and they did all these terrible things. They they sent Trotsky over to Russia. They started the Federal Reserve. They did the 17th Amendment, which destroyed whatever, you know, kind of constitutional protection we had. That made it null and void right there by the direct election of senators instead of being appointed by the state legislatures. And the IRS and all these nasty things happened under the Woodrow Wilson administration, plus World War I, which they got us into, and the League of Nations.
Which coincided with getting the Federal Reserve System set up in the United States, legal.
All that
was done at the same time. Even the ADL was set up right after that.
That's exactly right. All these things started right in this period, Woodrow Wilson, by these guys. But then with the failure of the League of Nations, they said, well, no, we're going to do this right next time. So they started this organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, which, you know, is a spin-off of the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. But this is the engine of our destruction, this Council on Foreign Relations. 58 East 68th Street in Manhattan. So they're the ones that have put every single communist country under a communist dictatorship since Lenin and Trotsky. And when I say we, I refer to these characters.
And this is a part of the, you said somewhere that they are, what percentage, 70% Jews in the Council of Foreign Relations?
That's what they say today. That's what they estimate today, yes.
Okay, and this is a part of the Jewish rule, that you think that this is one of the strongholds that they're coming from, the Council of Foreign Relations.
Yeah, it's a Rothschild front, J.P. Morgan was a Rothschild agent, John D. Rockefeller, they were working for Rothschild, and this is Rothschild subversion, formalized. What the Council on Foreign Relations refers to the State Department. They were going to make all the appointments to the State Department.
Now, you also wrote here, I'm amazed, every single cabinet office under Clinton was headed by a Jew. My goodness.
Every single one at one point or another in those 8 years, yes.
Oh, you mean each cabinet office was headed by a Jew at some point during those 8 years?
Yes.
Not all at the same time.
Well, most of them at the same time, but Mike Espy was Secretary of Agriculture, I think, then he was replaced by a Jewish guy. I can't remember his name, but...
Okay. And so now here, we don't even notice this. You know, the American people don't notice this. If somebody points it out to them, as I said, some of the, liberals or others will say, oh, don't talk about the Jews. That just so happens that way. Now, how do we get so ignorant? And what do we do about this ignorance?
Well, I think the ignorance is kind of dissipating now. There's been an explosion of information thanks to the Internet. You know, it never would have happened if it weren't for the Internet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's happening. People such as yourself spreading the word. It's really, really happening. And the ADL is terrified. Now, Abe Foxman, about 3 weeks ago, sent out a warning, an alert to 700 different government agencies and newspapers and televisions, warning about veterans today, saying it had to be shut down. It's a horrible, horrible thing. Well, he was unsuccessful. Now, he would have been successful probably 5 years ago, but now nobody cares of what Jews have to say. You know, they're just fed up with these people and how vicious they are against the Palestinians, and what we find out about 9/11. We find out everything has got these people behind it secretly.
Well, there's some recent developments about 9/11, but I don't want to go into those because we don't have time for it.
Okay.
And but another time, and of course, people find that elsewhere. You are promoting something called the ADJA. Tell us about that. I liked that very much.
Yeah, DAJA, Daja.
Oh, DAJA.
Defense Against Jewish Aggression. And that's just to me something, I started the militia movement and it exploded into this multi-million guy thing. I mean, there was no formal membership in the militia. It was just a state of mind. And that's really what I'm going to try to do with this Defense Against Jewish Aggression, or DAJA. It's got kind of a exotic sound to it. I think it can be promoted and I think people will respond to this idea. We must defend ourselves against Jewish aggression, whether it's Bernie Madoff or the Wall Street thing or the Federal Reserve or what's going on in Beirut. You know, it's all the same thing. We just have to grow up, wake up, and disenfranchise these people.
Well, I think that I just really like that you came up with a name for something. I mean, we need to think in terms of something that people can rally around, and I think that's excellent. There's too much where we just talk and talk and talk about it. David Duke said recently on a radio program on this network that we are vastly in the majority. We could do this if people would just say we're going to do it, but we can't. This kind of mind control that we're under, and you use that term. That's where I got it. This mind control we're under, that doesn't allow us to do anything. Now, here's another thing you said. Maybe I quoted that one already. Jewish rule must be prevented at all costs. you know, if we don't have that kind of, see, you say, I believe that. If we don't have that kind of mentality, we're not going to do it. And we have to have that kind of mentality. And it's so important because otherwise, as I said in the first half, our ignorance is going to, we're going to wake up too late and we're already going to be in the concentration camp, you know, and we're already going to be our lives are going to be ended. So you say, get ready for action, be prepared to kill or get killed. Now, I'm not trying to promote something here that I'm not capable of carrying out, but I think this kind of talk is necessary, and I'm glad actually that you're on, you don't have this one on there, but that you're on a website that has such a huge readership, and you can say some of the things that you're saying there.
Yeah, they're not holding me back at all. This is a wonderful opportunity that I have and others have to be.
Well, you're the only one on there that's like you. I mean, there are people saying different things, but they're in a different league from you. So I hope you'll be able to stay. But be prepared to kill or get killed. If we don't understand that this is what it's all about, this is not paranoia, this is not exaggeration. This, if you just look around, as you say, this is the reality that's going on.
Yeah, we just have to, wake up and smell the gefilte fish, as I like to say.
Yeah, but, you know, everybody says that. But, how do we do it? So I like this defense against Jewish aggression because it points out that it is Jewish aggression. And I think you point that out in everything that you write.
Yeah, I'm kind of a one-note Charlie. But I always like to quote Rabbi Stephen Wise. He was the chief rabbi of the United States back during the Roosevelt days. And his famous quote was, some call it Marxism. I call it Judaism. So that's what we're up against.
Yeah, exactly. So we will continue on with this kind of thinking. I hope that you will come on the program again. We'll talk more about this and anything you want to talk about. I will be talking about the Jewish defense against Jewish aggression. That we all need to become more aware of. So, anything? What else would you like to say before we have to bring the program to a close, Bruce?
Well, I'm really happy to have made the connection with Dmitry Kalazov, the former Soviet officer. Now, you know, I was the hardest core anti-communist SOB in America, I'm sure, but. He and I have really got a wonderful thing going here. He's over in Bangkok, and he's revealing that the Israeli Mossad brought down 9/11, or brought on 9/11, and was totally responsible for the attack. Mm-hmm. So you can check that out on Veterans Today. It's quite fascinating.
Yes, and there's a link to his book, which I have, and I looked it over. I didn't read it all yet. I probably won't read it all. I don't want to get into that much detail. Mm-hmm. But, you get the picture, and there are a lot of pictures, too, and it's pretty exciting. Anyway, anything that continues to move these things along is good. So, all right, Bruce, thank you very much for coming on the program, and hope to see you again. Ladies and gentlemen, this was J. Bruce Campbell, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, saying good night. I plan to have next week Professor Andreas Wesserle talking about the Nuremberg Tribunal, but before that, the Morgenthau Plan, so it'll fit right in.
Okay.
Good night for now.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.